Accession number 10293, rule 1.
Mr. Smith, 301. Can you tell me when it was and how it was that you first joined the Royal Air Force?
Yes, it was when I was at high school, about 16 years old, and I was talking to a friend of mine who'd joined the Air Force about 6 months before me, told me what a good life it was. It was something that I was sort of interested in just a little at the time, but after reading all the papers about it, I realised I could get into the type of work that I wanted to be, which I was fond of electrics and radio sort of stuff. And I applied for an apprenticeship in the Royal Air Force. Then I had to take the usual examinations and go for my medicals. Eventually I was accepted as an apprentice to be trained in wireless and electrical mechanics.
Where was that?
I went to Cranwell, actually, for my training in the RAF.
What was it like at Cranwell?
Hard.
In what way?
Well, you're 16 years old, you're going to do a 3 years apprenticeship, and you're starting off as an absolutely raw schoolboy type, and you've got to be finished up as a trained soldier completely, which means square bashing, PT, physical fitness, games, all sorts of things, everything else. And they take you right through for 3 years. When you first start off, it's mainly the discipline side with the square bashing and everything else, and a little bit of general education thrown in. And then as you go through the 3 years, your physical side goes down and your academical training increases, so that you start off basic stuff you've done at school, physics, chemistry, and ordinary grammar, literature, all the English sort of stuff that you've done before. And then they gradually work you on to electrics, radio, magnetic circuits, then start teaching you things like the Morse code and semaphore flagging, go right through. Then they take you on to practical sides, where you have training in carpentry, joinery, fitting, blacksmiths, welding, silversmiths. You go right through, and for 3 years you really are working all day and some evenings. But at the end of it, you have the finest training in the world. There's no doubt about that. It's accepted that an RAF apprenticeship is the finest training in the world, in your radio, electrical and fitting and rigging trades. And there's nothing to beat it.
What's the difference between electrical and wireless fitter and a wireless operator?
The electrical fitter nowadays, at the time when I was there, an electrical fitter and a wireless fitter were the same. It was one trade, because radio is not as advanced as it is today, now with the electrical side. So we used to do both jobs. The electrical fitter works purely and simply on motors, engines, stuff like that. He doesn't touch anything on the radio side. But nowadays, the radio fitter, or the radio mechanic, he is the chap who repairs the equipment. Then they have wireless operators, which we used to have when I was there as well, wireless operators, but they only do wireless operating. Whereas the apprenticeship that I did covers full electrical fitting, full radio fitting, and wireless operating, be it ground or air. You're able to do every job in those trades.
Were you keen to get onto a squadron and get away from the training?
Yes, I suppose we all were. 3 years is a long time when you're under the knuckle the whole time, really. That's what the moms do, because discipline was very strict.
In what way? Can you give any
examples? In every way. Can I give an example? Yes. We had a scare one time that was diphtheria or something like that. Excuse me. And I had an inoculation which went wrong. And the next day my arm was swollen up to about twice or three times its size. So, of course, I had to report sick and have something done about it. And this was on the Saturday morning. Now, Saturday morning is the drill morning when you do the big parade. The whole camp parades on the square and the CO comes around and everything else. And because the arm didn't affect my normal work like going to school, I was put on what they call medicine and duty. In other words, you report for treatment, but you do full duties. And I had to go on this parade with my rifle, which I couldn't lift under my shoulder. And I was told, you will be on parade, your M&D, you will be on parade. So, of course, as soon as I got on parade and started to try and throw the rifle around, my rifle was way out compared with the others. It wasn't going up fast enough, and I couldn't bend my arm, so I wasn't at the slope, I was only at the half slope.
Do you consider that now to be meaningless and bull, or do you think there was some logical purpose to it?
There was a lot of logical purpose to the bull that we had. Let me be honest, I agree with it, but I thought that was a bit silly. When I'd explained to them that my arm was in bandages, that I couldn't bend it, they should have accepted the fact, but they didn't. But that was the way they were. It was strict. You were medicine in duty. You were fit for work. You did 100% of that work. And yet I wasn't really, but it was only just a simple thing. I just couldn't bend my arm. They kicked me off the parade, of course. The flight sergeant came along and said, get off. Out of the way. Go and do some other work. And of course they put me on fatigues and that sort of thing. But that was where discipline was too strict. Just a little bit over-strict on a thing like that. He could have accepted my explanation to me in the first place and said, that's it. There's another example. There's one that... when we used to go on leave, and we were below 18-year-old, we used to be given a pass, and also the pass was signed half fare, so you could get half fare on the trains for going home on your annual leaves. And we had one chap, and he wasn't over 18, and he got his form pass, and he got a spare pass, and he just signed the name at the bottom of it, and he was found out. And they said he'd signed the CO's name, therefore it was forgery. And he was put up for forgery, and he was given nine strokes of the lash.
In public?
Well, our squadron wasn't there, because he was a member of our squadron, but some of the other ones were, yeah.
How did they react to it? Did they think it was unfair or not?
I don't know. He said, I'll make sure I never do a thing like that again. It was sort of, I suppose, it did its trick in as much as he, for a start, said, you know. But to me, I thought it was a little bit hard. That, fair enough, he signed a pass that he shouldn't have signed, but I didn't think it should have been classed as forgery.
Which squadron did you eventually go on to?
My first squadron was 72 Fighter Squadron at Church Fenton, but... When I got there, I was actually told straight away that I was on the boat for going overseas, so I wasn't going to be on the squadron for very long. But that was 1938, and if you remember, in 1938, it was when Chamberlain went to Munich, and the war was put off for the time being anyway. He came back with this piece of paper, so we were recalled back from our leave and just put on the normal squadron duties. So I was there for about a month or so, just servicing gladiators, radio equipment gladiators that the pilots used to use because they didn't have any observers in those aircraft. And then, of course, everything blew over, so they said, oh, well, you can go overseas now. So once again, I went on leave, cleared from the camp, and finally went overseas.
I think that was to India.
That was to India, yes.
And... Can you tell me how you found service life in India before the war?
Marvellous.
Why?
Marvellous. we used to get up too hot in India to work in the afternoon, so because you never worked in the afternoon. So all you did was, during the winter, you got up reasonably early and worked till lunchtime. In the summer, you got up very early and... after about an hour and a half of work, you went back and had breakfast, and they went back for another 2 hours. So that long before lunchtime, say 11, half past 11, you'd finish for the day because it was too hot. So all you did then was you had your lunch and you went to bed for the afternoon. That's what everybody did. The whole place used to just close down in the afternoon and you went to bed. Then in the evening, you just went out or sat around in the barracks and things like that, or you went out into the town or the local village, townships, and enjoyed yourself. So you were only working for 3 or 4 hours a day. In those days, the Raj was definitely supreme. So if you were white, you were a top dog. Even as an AC2, you were still a Bodhisattva. And you had everything done for you because you had batmen, you had waiters, you had bearers. So you didn't have to polish any buttons or boots or do any laundry or clean the barrack rooms or anything. It was all done for you. And all you did was you paid your bearer about 12 annas a week, which is about a shilling. And you probably paid the dhobi about sixpence, that's the washerman. And that was it. Everything else was done for you.
Were there any drawbacks to service in India?
Not from my point of view, no, I don't think so. I enjoyed my time in India. I moved around. I don't know how many different countries I saw, because we were a squadron that used to be pushed across to different places. I started off in Lahore. From Lahore we went to Peshawar because we were doing all the troop work and troop carrying and the sickness, people with illnesses or wounds and that sort of thing. We were on a transport squadron then. I was on the Army Co-op squadron first, which would work with the Army, and then I was on the transport squadron, which once again worked with the Army, helping them out. And no problems. We it was very interesting.
Were there any special incidents that happened to you in India which can be recounted?
Probably one towards the end, which isn't India so much as Burma. In India itself, we moved around. We did a hell of a lot of, you know, ferrying, different types of work. We did the Chitral Relief, which is an outpost right on the frontier, right up virtually towards the Russian border and Afghanistan-Russian border. And it used to take the army up to 3 months to complete the Chitral Relief, because they had to march out and carry stuff out by mules. But when we became a transport squadron, we did the Chitral Relief. In other words, we swapped over the soldiers. We brought the old soldiers out and took the new batch in. And we completed the whole thing in a fortnight instead of 3 months. It meant flying over very high ground, so much so that you couldn't fly over the top of it. You had to fly through the valleys. And I've got photographs where you're flying along, and believe me, you feel as though you can touch the sides of the ravines as you're going through. They're so narrow. But the army thought it was marvelous that, you know, they'd got a complete changeover of personnel in 14 days instead of 3 months. That was very interesting, I thought. Of course, I didn't stay in India the whole of the 5 years I was across with that squadron, because after Peshawar we came across, we went to Iraq to do the Iraq rebellion. When they rebelled, we had a ferry cruise out there. Then when we finished that part, the other flight went across the Western Desert, and they were doing work on the Western Desert. And then when they came back to India, and we'd sort of had our rest period, we went into Burma and we did the evacuation of Burma. So the whole time, you never stayed really in one spot very long. Although we were basically an Indian squadron stationed in India, we moved all over the place. We moved in different countries, different places. And at one time, I went on a fortnight detachment up the Persian Gulf, surveying the Persian Gulf. That was very interesting because it was an exercise with the Army, Navy and the Air Force, surveying for Air Force landings, for flying boat landings, and for the Navy to take over bases up the Gulf, to give an alternative route through to the Far East if they needed one ever.
Sorry?
An alternative route to the Far East.
When was this?
That was about 1941, I think. A little vague on some of these dates now, it's a long time ago.
Could you tell me in detail what part you played in this evacuation of Iraq at the time of Rashid Ali's revolt?
Well, we were actually ferrying troops in. This was our main job, was to ferry the troops in and, you know, to go across Rashid Ali and get rid of him. And then afterwards, we were doing transportation of... we had Gurkhas and people like that there. I know that one time I had to do a flight where we transported two Gurkhas who had been bitten by crocodiles. So it was mainly ferrying troops in and doing relief work and Red Cross type of work.
Where were you flying from?
Habaniya and Shaiba in Iraq.
You were flying from there or to there?
No, from there. We were based up in Habaniya first and then Shaiba.
And where would you fly to?
We flew into Persia, Iraq, Iran, Persia, Iran. One time I had to go right up to virtually on the Russian border to bring back a soldier who'd badly burnt himself with his engine caught fire in his truck, and we had to go up and bring him back. A lot of Red Cross work it was, the second part.
Did you see anything of the fighting against Rashid Ali's forces?
No, I didn't do the first couple of weeks, so I missed the actual fighting.
Did you speak to anybody who had?
Oh, yes. I mean, some of the chaps in my own squadron were in it, and there's a funny thing about that as well. And that is, one aeroplane had gone up, a local aeroplane from Habaniya had gone up, and the pilot had been shot. And there was a young LAC who was on board who took over the plane and he landed it. Although he was not a pilot, he landed it with I think the pilot was dead, actually. And years later, when I joined the RAF Association Hull, one of the chaps I was talking to was that chap's brother.
Did the people who'd seen the fighting against Rashid Ali describe it as difficult, or was it just a pushover?
No, I think it was a matter of bluff, actually, because Rashid Ali said, you know, get out of there or we're going to bomb hell out of you. And the AOC in charge there at the time, this is what I understand, was just as wily as Rashid Ali, because he sent a message up and said, if you don't get off the top of that plateau, I shall knock hell out of you. And although they had nothing to do it with a few planes plus our transport aircraft were capable of carrying bombs as well. And we just went up and blew them up a bit and frightened them off.
So neither Rashid Ali nor the AOC had the capacity to do what they said?
No, neither. But the AOC was the winner.
What did you think to the bases at Habaniya and Shaiba as compared with those in India that you've been familiar with, like Peshawar and Lahore?
Oh, completely different, because up there you had the camp and there was nothing else. To get to any place of any size, you had to go miles and miles and miles. Whereas in India, where you have a large cantonment, you have not just the Air Force, you have the Army to go with you. So you have a full military garrison of Army and Air Force. In Iraq, there's no Army. It was purely Air Force. So you just had an RAF station inside a barbed wire perimeter. So there was nothing much to do at night or anything except on the camp. Whereas in India, at least you could get down to, for example, when I was in Lahore City, was only about 10 miles away. You could sort of get a gharry down there in about 15 minutes or so like that. In Peshawar, well, of course, Peshawar City is inside the cantonment. It's inside the garrison bounds. So you can walk into the city part of it, the native part of it. But in Habaniya, you've got to go... Well, I had toothache once there, really bad about toothache, and I had to go 50 miles to get it seen to. So it was completely the more isolated in Iraq than it is in India, definitely.
So which did you prefer?
India.
And contact with the people in Iraq and India, how did that compare?
Well, there was no contact with people in Iraq, really, because the only contact you had during the time I was there was just your batmen and bearers, nobody else. You never saw any of the local natives in that much floating around, because the people who lived on the camp, of course, were camp followers, so they were virtually like us in a way. They were black and worked for the squadron, the same as we were white and worked for the squadron. In India, of course, it's different. You met the civilian black people as well as the military black people.
I've talked to people who served at Shaiba before the war, who describe something of a zany atmosphere, that people were, according to him, almost going round the bend because of the boredom there. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Yes. You've obviously never heard the song Shaiba Blues.
I think he did mention this.
Yeah.
What was it exactly?
The Shaiba Blues is just as I'm fed up and I'm brushed off and, you know, all that sort of thing. And it's just a ditty they have about Shaiba.
So was there something peculiar or special about Shaiba?
No, it's just the fact that you are in an isolated spot in very close surroundings with the same people day in and day out, and there's nothing else to do.
But more so than Havania?
No, I would think Havania is probably about the same. Havania they call the coffin camp.
Coffin?
Coffin camp. It's shaped like a coffin.
Did the word coffin have any other significance?
No, not so much. No, just it was, when you were flying over, it was shaped like a coffin, so they called it the coffin camp.
Can you tell me about how you went off to the Burma campaign in 1942, the circumstances? Was it the whole of 31 squadron that went?
No. As I was saying before, part of the squadron would go one way and the other part would go the other. So you'd probably have one squadron doing a detachment overseas and the other half would be in India virtually on a relaxation period doing local work. And it just happened that I'd been to Iraq and I came home. I had a period of local work in India, and then the Burma do came up and it was necessary to start evacuating Burma. So my half of the squadron, which was A flight, flew down to Dum Dum at Calcutta shortly before the Christmas, and from there we were flying in and out of Burma, bringing the wounded out the whole time. Carrying wounded only, we didn't carry any able-bodied people, they had to fight their way out, but the wounded we brought out.
What kind of planes were doing the ferrying work?
We started off with the old Vickers Valencias, and then we converted on to DC-2s, which are the small type of Dakota, and then on the Dakota itself, which is a DC-3. So we started off with the old aircraft and finished up with the American DCs, the Dakotas as they call them nowadays. And as we withdrew from Burma, we had to change positions. We went up into Assam to Dinjan and Tezpur.
Dinjan?
Dinjan. D-I-N-J-A-N.
And Tezpur?
T-E-Z-P-U-R. And we were flying from there and going in and out to Burma until finally, of course, they were beaten right back to the Irrawaddy and the mountains. And there was really no further place the Japanese could go except round the corner and or over the mountains. And, of course, that was where they got held up then, as they got onto the borders of Assam.
How suitable were the Valencias and the Dakotas for doing this evacuation work?
Well, Valencia was really too old and slow, but it did the job. But Dakotas, I'm probably a bit rude here, but I always say they're the only good things that came out of America. Because I'm not pro USA. I'm a bit anti-USA. But the Dakota is a good aircraft, no doubt about it. And they were nice to fly in, and they did the job that they had to do.
And what kind of airstrips were you flying into in Burma?
Just landing fields of any sort. If you hit a good landing strip, fair enough, yes, you know. But not aerodromes as such, you know, that you know today with big long runways and everything else.
And presumably it was all pre-arranged, was it? Or did you just land anywhere?
Well, I suppose there were certain places which had these landing strips. See, in those days we didn't need runways for things like Dakotas and Wapitis and that. And Vickers Valencias, you didn't need runways. You landed them on grass. So any good large field that was fairly flat was good enough for an airstrip.
And what can you describe the crew of the Valencia and the Dakota that would go in?
Yes, the Valencia had two pilots, a wireless operator, and probably a fitter or a rigger to go with it where help was needed. But the Dakota was virtually the same, two pilots, a wireless operator. And whilst we were evacuating, actually, that was the full crew, two pilots, one wireless operator, because we had to get as many passengers on board as we could. So every available space had to be taken up, so we didn't take an extra bot with us. We just the three crew.
And how many could you evacuate at a time?
Well, when we first started off into Vickers Valencia, I should think about 14 to 20 at the most. The Dakota, the small Dakota, was only a 12-seater, so we probably got 14 people in there because we took the seats out. Took the seats out. So they sat around, laid on the floor and all sorts of things like that, and stretcher cases we had to put in there. We could probably bring out about 14, and then we got the Dakotas, they brought out a few more because they're slightly bigger. And then we had two sergeant pilots who said, we can put more in than this. And they put a few extra in. And then when they put a few extra in, the CO said, oh yes, we can put a few extra in. So the two sergeants says, right, we can put four more in the next time. And they built it up until we were carrying up to 30 people out at a time, which really was quite a load.
Can you describe any of the people that you remember whom you brought out?
The people I brought out? Mostly, I would say, my impression of is purely and simply wounded soldiers with bandages all around them, arms in slings, arms stuck up. And because of the very meagre medical facilities in Burma, virtually they were just wrapped in a sort of plaster Paris, plaster bandage, anything they could get to stop the wound from bleeding or anything like that, and then just stuck on a plane and brought out. So we saw people coming out like that, where even the blood and the pus was coming through the plaster bandages. But as to faces, not really. You were there, you did your job, and that was it. We used to start off first light in the morning, the ground crew, well, before it was light, the ground crew would get out of their camp beds. We were sleeping in tents. And we went down to the airfield, walked down to the airfield, and in the semi-darkness, we'd check our aircraft, run them up, and get them all set, ready for the air crew to arrive. At first light, they would arrive, and we had four aircraft, and they would take off for Burma. Naturally, coming back, they were staggered, because they would have to wait for, you know, loading at the other end and things like that. So they tend to get slightly staggered throughout the day. So the first one came back, you unloaded it, 9 times out of 10, of course, half a dozen have been sick in it. You cleaned them up, refueled as necessary, turned them round, pilots jumped and wireless jumped on board, and back they went.